All right, good morning, everyone. So this is really actually a pretty tight, targeted session. We got like 45 minutes, and it's intended to just give really some chomer lemachshava. So I think actually the way I want to do this, rather than having like a prolonged back and forth on each line, I want to try to take you through a couple of things here very quickly, give you a picture of some different ways of talking about it, and then we'll circle back like on the whole package and talk about, both can be from a text perspective, but also, bringing in kind of life perspective and insights on this. So what I tried to put together on this sheet here, and this is something I think I've thought about for many years, like I will put it out there, I have an instinct to want to be normal. I just want to say that, like, I have that instinct. I have an instinct to, like, make things be unobtrusive, flow well, both in terms of, like, navigating my own, like, life of observance. I'll tell you a story that actually captures maybe some desire to be normal, but then also confronting my limits of, like, how normal I could be with certain commitments. So when I was in eighth grade, I participated in a national math competition. Some of you may have heard of it. It's called Math Counts. And I was in a room with this other guy who was part of the Connecticut state team with me in this hotel. And I sort of realized it was the first time I was ever confronted, who was not Jewish. And I was confronting, this was the first time since my bar mitzvah that I was going to be like waking up, putting on tefillin in front of total stranger who themselves like had no exposure to it. And I'm actually like amazed at myself, like thinking back, that I like managed this situation as well as I did. But basically, you know, I sort of remember having this instinct at the time. It was like, well, I'm not gonna not put on tefillin. So like, obviously I'm doing that. That's the like, you know, my inner commitment. But I'm also not just gonna be like getting up in the morning and putting on tefillin like without warning him or like that would be totally bizarre. Like, and I want to be normal, right? While wearing leather boxes. I had this sort of, you know, like sheepish engagement with him like the day before. I was like, just so you know, like I get up in the morning and I, you know, say some prayers. I might be wearing these leather straps, like no big deal. But I think that was part of this instinct to say, you know, how do you take like these commitments that you have and as much as possible, and that's like a pretty hard one to do that way, like try to make people feel like, no, I'm not actually trying to be completely different, opposed, foreign to you. Just doing this and trying to do it, you know, in your context. So that's just like me and my biography that has led me to kind of think about this over the years. And I think what I've struggled with is I felt like, yeah, that's maybe like a personality trait, but is there any internal language for thinking about it and like actually affirming it through rabbinic sources? So I already quoted the first source here, I already quoted in my introduction, this I think very powerful articulation of not sitting when people are standing, standing when people are sitting. We'll get to like when this does and doesn't apply. That'll be the sort of interesting thing, because right, what do you imagine here? It's like the people who like they go to a conservative shul, but they're leaping up to stand for Kaddish because they're like, well, I stand for Kaddish, but in that shul, it's like only the mourners stand. Or people who like they used to not sitting standing for Kaddish, and they're like in an Orthodox shul, and they're like, well, I'm conservative, so I'm sitting, right? Like this text is trying to somehow push back on either of those dynamics and be like, hey, like, why don't you see what the Romans are doing and try to more or less be a Roman and fit in. Lo yishane adam midat tabriyot. Another case that is very well known in this regard, but I think we don't often realize that this language is used for it. The famous sugya, the discussion in the Talmud, here I brought in its original form, Masechet Kala Rabbati, between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. How does one praise a bride at a wedding? Right? And Beit Shammai's position is basically like, you tell it like it is. You know, so you don't flatter or lie about anything. The Torah says, Midvar Sheker Tirchak. So, yeah, maybe you don't say something nasty, but you don't make up anything that you don't really believe to be true. Whereas Beit Hillel say, nope, no matter what it is, you say, Kala Na'ava Chasuda. You say, this person is basically, essentially, both internally and externally beautiful. And you just say that all the time. And the question comes up, right? How is it that that interacts with the prohibition on lying? So if you look here at, if you look at the third source here, the Piskei Reed, the Reed is an Italian Rishon, says, Mikan amru chachamim, quoting the end of the Gemara, like, what's the value here? Tehei da'ato shel adam me'orevet im habriot. There is this value that you are supposed to conduct yourself in a way that people will feel that you are like a part of them and mixed in with them and somehow like part of their community. And what is the ramification, says the Reed, of Beit Hillel's position here? Perush, lomar davar mitkabel ve'afal pisho omer sheker. That you should say and speak, and I would say conduct yourself in a way that people will receive, that will be well received, even if you have to lie. Right? So this, I think, is actually a very dramatic and straight-up way of essentially saying, like, yeah, I mean, going back, just referring back to my introduction, right? It's like, yeah, no, you don't, like, stand on the other side of the river and, like, say all kinds of crazy things and throw bombs. You get a sense, what's the group that I'm in? How could, doesn't mean I have nothing to say, but how do I, like, fit in and essentially be a functioning member of that group? And this notion of liod me'orevet im abriot, da'at abriot, I think is one piece of language for that. Yeah, I brought you this passage from the Toldot Yitzchak, which is, this is the father of Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, brings a beautiful perush on the Torah's puzzling comment that Yosef, Yisrael havet Yosef mikol banav. Okay, right? Yaakov loves Yosef more than any other of his sons. And then it says, kiven zekunim hulo. And the Toldot Yitzchak is bothered by that, because that means because he was a son from his old age. But he points out, if you look at the chronology, it's like Yisachar is like, you know, 3 years older than Yosef. Like, there's no real gap there. So what does it mean? It can't really be that he was in his old age. And he says that's not what it means. He says what Yosef was a manifestation of this principle of Le'olam Yehe Adam Da'ato Me'orevet Im Abriot. Yosef knew how to fit in. So what does it mean? When Yosef was with his older brothers, the brothers of Leah, he was roe et echav batzon. He acted like a shepherd who was like seriously involved in the work. When he was with some of his younger brothers of Bilhah and Zilpah, v'hu na'ar et b'nei Zilhah v'et b'nei Zilpah, then he would act more like a fun-loving kid. And when he was with his father, he knew how to be in the company of an old man. In other words, he was a ben zikunim, a son who was attuned to what it is to be elderly. And none of the other kids of Yaakov knew how to do that. Like, they only knew how to be, you know, some version of themselves, but they couldn't sort of mold themselves to the environment. And Yosef, in that way, here it's imagined as a high character trait. He knows how to actually respond emotionally to that environment and to fit in to kind of the needs and the context. All right, so that's concept one. As I said, I want to just kind of take us through these and then we'll discuss. So that's one notion, I think, one language that's really interesting, da'at habriyot. The second is kind of from a religious perspective. That is to say, if normalcy in the first category here is about how do we respond on a human level to the people who are around us, then there's the question of what are the ramifications of either fitting in or not fitting in for the things we stand for. In other words, what's likely to be the success rate of the values we embody if people perceive us as other as opposed to of within? And here there's some really interesting passages that discuss this notion of Shem Shamayim Mitahev Al Yadecha. So here in the Talmud Bavli and Yoma, we won't read the whole thing, but really just the first line. Right? Hechidame Chilul Hashem. What does Chilul Hashem look like? How do we define what it is to desecrate God's name? Abaye says, this is captured by the following braita. Ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha. What does it actually mean to love God? Right, and I think this midrash is grappling with the notion of like, God doesn't need us to love God. God is not, like, Heschel aside, right? This text is saying, is not focusing on God's emotional neediness. This must be a command to behave in the world that will organically increase love for God. Okay, that's the reading here. Ve'ahavta means, by your actions, that the name of heaven will become more beloved. And then it lists a whole bunch of other things that essentially will lead someone to be kind of admired by other people. Okay? Now, that opening phrase, though, then is taken, I think, by a number of later interpreters to say, well, sometimes the way you make people like you or admire the things you stand for is they don't perceive you as to be completely crazy. So if you look on the other side here, the Nishmat Chaim, this is by Rav Chaim Berlin, after whom a very important yeshiva was named in the United States, the son of the Netziv of Volozhin. So he says as follows, he's discussing here the question, someone has asked him a question, what about shaking hands with either someone who is, you know, wicked, or I have some kind of like values conflict with them, that's like one set of concerns. And then the question about what about shaking hands with a woman who is not Jewish, who is from outside the community, who may not know the norms that this person is presuming of, like, well, men and women are not going to shake hands in the Jewish community. But what if I encounter someone in work and whatever it is, and there's some moment where there's expected physical contact, like, how do I respond to that? And he says something actually very interesting here. So three lines from the bottom. After saying, okay, look, if you can avoid it, fine, that's great. But, right? If this Gentile woman that you're speaking about extended her hand to you, and you know, you're not in some inappropriate way, chas v'shalom, actually thinking about this being as some kind of inappropriate sexual interaction, of course, it shouldn't be strict about not shaking her hand. Why? Its ways are supposed to be pleasing, the ways of the Torah. But what did they say in the Gemara? You don't want to create a situation where you are an ambassador for the notion that to be committed to mitzvot is to be a total kook, right? You're a mishuga, and they're not normal. I actually think, like, einam ba'alei derech eretz is basically that. Like, I don't do normal things. I went to that guy. He wouldn't shake my hand. I can't even believe that, right? Now, of course, like, what are the limits on this principle is always an interesting one, but I think this is some of the, like, language for that instinct here, not just serving my kind of relationship with the person, but also, like, even in the goal of, like, I want to stand for something, I want to be an effective ambassador, what are the other elements of my behavior that make it plausible for people to view me as a role model, right? And actually having to think about that. Okay, let me actually pause there, all right? Because then we're going to look quickly at a sugya and some interesting discussion of it, which I think will make it a little concrete. Thoughts, questions, reflections, again, either on what we've seen or, you know, from your own perspective on this stuff. Yeah, we'll take a couple in concert. So Taylor, then Daniel. And then Tara.
Something I think about in terms of, like, ways of the world and then, like, when to be, like, more stringent on things is, like, rabbinic versus, like, biblical prohibitions, like, especially when I'm with people who are not Shabbat observant or not Kashrut observant, especially when that's family. And I was wondering, like, how you think that fits in. Like, for example, like, touching or shaking hands with a woman, like, what is the line, and when can you say, like, okay, this is okay to not seem like a crazy, versus, like, no, I'm not gonna, like, start a bonfire on Shabbat just because, like, that's the cool thing to do.
Great. I'll just take a couple of these so we get some more voices and I come back.
So it's something I think about a lot in interacting with students or social setting. This is actually, like, I don't know, for me, like, sometimes a very hard thing to do when, you know, for instance, you're in a professional setting and people go for, like, a business lunch or whatever, right? To be the person who, like, you know, ordering a salad or something that's, like, fairly safe, you know, but, like, ranging all the way up to, like, ordering nothing when you're in, like, a setting where it's really normal to eat. I think it's a really sort of tricky world to navigate that, like,
Tara.
I struggle with what feels normal to me is what I grew up with, and it's so hard to recalibrate no matter how many different communities I immerse myself in. There's something about the power of what you grew up with, and that's also, like, a kind of scary power for imposing on a future generation.
Yeah, no, I very much resonates with me all that's been said. I mean, look, Taylor, going back to your question, I think, you know, look, internally, let's say Rav Chaim Berlin here, he doesn't think he's counseling the person to do anything forbidden, but he's trying to sort of shore up and like, here's why you should actually feel, not just I'm giving you a leniency, but given that this is permitted, it's the affirmative right thing to do. And anytime you get to something of like, well, I normally consider this forbidden, but I'm suspending it, right? You're in obviously much more fraught territory. And I'm not sure, I think I struggle with this. Like, I'm not sure I would say the value of being normal is such that like, it overrides things that are prohibited. A lot of things, what I think is interesting is, internal to a lot of discussions of how to navigate situations like that might be, well, there's some other situation you're dealing with there, whether it's respect for your parents or it's concern for this, that, or the other thing that might warrant, you know, treating various things in a different way in that context. I mean, that goes back to the metaphor that I said, right? How are you a vertebrate and not an invertebrate on this stuff? And I think that line is really important. What I find these sources to speak to, though, is to sort of, I guess I'm trying to a little bit sanctify the instinct, at least, when possible, for things not to be jarring, right? Like, going back to my example, it's like, no, I wasn't going to not put on tefillin. I'll get to, there's a tour here we'll see at the end, which I think is really important in that regard, and we'll respond. But how do I make it be, like, as not glaringly, you know, sticking out as possible? And on some level, the question of, like, what you grow up with and what you move on to is really tricky in that way also, because it's like, what's the point of, like, the Torah, or for that matter, any value system, if it can't move people, right? Like, in other words, if all it does is reconfirm existing power structures, existing conventions, it's like, what is that, right? And yet, there is this tough thing, which part of me wants to say it's not just that. It's like, in other words, the desire to somehow not be in rupture from where one comes from a place of wanting to not have like a splitting of the psychic self, which like I think long term, it's very hard to live in a place like that, where you completely cut off from some formal sense, even if you want to grow. I think that's very real. I mean, look, again, you're raising some of there's practical questions associated with that. But I think the real thing, right, is like, I think the sources here are not trying to say that everything a person does fits in completely seamlessly. But are there ways in which you try to make aspects of yourself and behave in ways that then other things that are a little unusual or different fit into a picture of relatability, right, in some kind of way? And I think there is that line, right? There's that line where how do you... We have interesting historical examples of this. Like, Ashiah Cohen writes in his book, The Beginnings of Jewishness, cites some Roman authors that anyone who tells you they're a vegetarian is minastam a Jew. This is in the ancient world. It's actually unbelievable. Okay? What I think is, first of all, it's fascinating historically, but there's something fascinating about why are those people saying they're vegetarians as opposed to I keep the biblical laws of kashrut? There was some instinct there of like, I'm not going to eat stuff, but I don't necessarily want to wallop this person over the head with the full covenantal frame. I want to like block for myself to maintain my integrity, but maybe in language that, until I'm masked by this guy, right, will be understood as like, oh, okay, like, you know, I can get that. Which goes back, I mean, this is where the environment question is also, like, important, right? There's some environments that are more hospitable to that than others, right? Like, you are in certain parts of the United States, saying you're a vegetarian is super helpful, and in other parts, it's like, what are you talking about, right? And that's even changed, right, in the last few decades. But yeah, maybe a few more comments on this piece, and then we'll look at this last section. So, you three.
What about cases where there's an externality of what you're doing? Meaning, not the cases of, do I stand or sit? But the cases of, so I'm, for example, I as a Levi often find myself in synagogues that militantly and vehemently do not consider going to Levi status when assigning Aliyah. And the problem is, as a Levi, I need a Kohen in the room to get on board with me so I can have an Aliyah. So I married one to try to make that but sometimes she's not there, and that still requires a three-party coordination. Mm-hmm. And so then it's not just oh, I will or won't take Aaliyah, but it's, is there a Kohen in the room? Do you know that? Do they know that? And have you already given out the first Aaliyah, please? Right? Like, you know, that when these become more than one party decisions, and I can give you, you know,
yeah,
examples, but how does that play into this?
Good. So we're going to see this last section, I think, will elicit that. So we'll come back to that. Yeah, Jana, and then Sigal.
I'm interested in how you present your, well, the very fact that I'm using this word is, you know, is telling, your idiosyncrasy, which in a space where you're trying to be normal, saying, or where you're trying to be, like, less jarring, saying it's an idiosyncrasy is actually, you know, it's actually a way of speaking in language that people following a certain path can understand, because there is a place in every setting for, like, the thing that falls outside of that setting. So, you know, I think about my professional setting this summer, how much did I actually overstate the extent to which I eat this and don't eat that, because that was actually so catered to, literally, that I, that actually to sort of like present it with a certain kind of theatrics actually granted it so much more respect,
mm-hmm,
and felt like then like, oh God, you know, you know, I just hope the partner doesn't see me eating a salad down the block, because
right,
he's not going to get it.
Right.
No, like, he saw me eating a salad yesterday, but, like, you know, it had, like, some tinfoil around it. So whatever the situation is, and, you know, and think about, like, how much does, you know, saying, well, oh, I do this weird thing, and actually calling it that actually gives someone a frame they understand, because, like, oh, like, in every circumstance, there's someone doing a weird thing. And I live in, like, the weirdest place on earth now, which is Berkeley, California, which is a place where it must be the world capital of people having weird food things that they eat and don't eat.
Right.
And yet, if you tell them that you keep kosher, that is like, well, no. Like, oh, no, please. Like, you have a gluten allergy that...
I'm allergic to pig, camel, rock, high, rack.
If it's some, like, pseudoscientific health thing, then, like, everyone will roll out the red carpet for you and make sure that, like, not a speck of anything is in anything. But, like, so weirdness is actually celebrated, but you gotta be the right kind.
Mm-hmm.
And then in other settings that are, like, more normal and conservative, like a law firm,
yeah,
like, oh, well, yeah, she's, like, our interesting. that's normal.
Yeah.
So how you present it, I think, is like, you know, there's one spot reserved for you and the thing that no one else does.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is a certain kind of normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll come back to that in a second. Yes, yeah, so you go.
I'm interested in choosing the Briot, the year month,
mm-hmm,
and deciding to study in a certain place or be outside your comfort zone, leaving where your family lives. Choosing to raise a family in a certain space is choosing a kind of layout and choosing the problems you wish to encounter. And you could decide in other places you don't want to encounter these challenges, so you won't go study in a certain place, or you won't go and be me'olavin a briot, in a certain kind of briot. And I feel that this is a choice that we make all the time. And we decide what's important to us and what circumstances, and what price we're willing to pay. In order to be, you could have decided not to go to the math contest because you
right.
knew ahead of time you're going to be in a room with, you could have decided, you decided not to, and you decided what to do with the situation. And that's interesting for me of when do we make what decision? Where are our limits? And where we put ourselves out there?
Yeah, so let me just respond to a couple things there. I think the last point you're making, another dimension I would add to it is, there's also a difference, I think, between short-term and long-term arrangements, you know? And I think a lot of us have patience or the fortitude to be like, I would not want to have married someone where every morning I would have to explain that I was putting on clothes, right? Like, that would be totally intolerable. For a one-time weekend, right, that was fine. Maybe even for, like, 2 years, right? Or some, I think the notion of, like, do we have these chapters of lives, when I like your framing of, like, you know, which briot are we choosing? There is a sense, I think even this text, right? We'll see this in a second, right? Like, it's very easy to say, you know, lo yoshev ben haomdi. What's going to happen, which we'll see in an example in a minute. Well, like, okay, but what if, like, they are standing at a time where actually I really think they should be sitting? How long do I want to be in a community like that? Right? In other words, or I'm in a community that in no way values Jewish learning. I don't know. And I really do. how long do I want to be in that community as like shaping my entire life experience? That I think is a real major piece of it. That's also key. Going back to what you were saying, Janet, so I mean, I think the number of things that you raised, first of all, I would say, look, big picture, again, to reinforce what I said earlier, I think, yeah, you were standing for something there. I think it was probably, knowing you, in like a larger package of, but the rest of all of your interactions with those people was like basically indistinguishable from their interactions with everyone else in the firm. And that was a part of the package in which that distinctiveness was encased, as opposed to, I also dress different, I also talk different, all those things. And that is part of actually what enabled you, whether you're conscious of it or not, to come in and be like, you know, I want this. Now, some environments are more explicitly multicultural and embracing of difference in that way, where you can actually get away with being quote-unquote weirder, and it doesn't actually penalize you or hold you back, or actually even feel like you're somehow flouting norms, but a lot of them are not. So that's one thing. The second thing, which is interesting, which I think you're hinting at, is a lot of times when we make choices like this, it's about ourselves, but then a lot of times they have consequences for like other people in the ecosystem, right? In other words, what does it mean? I'll tell you two stories about this, okay? When my stepfather was first elected to the Senate, he came in, Howard Metzenbaum was still senator from Ohio, and the Senate had a recess for one day of Rosh Hashanah. That's what it had been. And my stepfather came in and was basically like, I need the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And Senator Metzenbaum was like, well, we've never done that before. You know, that's not... Eventually it pushed, it was worked out. The Republicans were much more helpful on this than the Democrats. That's another story. But there was a sense there where like, it wasn't just about like individual things, right? Metzenbaum's practice on Rosh Hashanah had ramifications for what it meant to be an observant Jew entering into that space, right? Another, so that's story one. Story two is another friend where they have an interesting mixed marriage. She grew up observant, you know, still davens three times a day, et cetera, totally kind of consistent pattern of observance her whole life. He grew up not ritually practicing in any way. And essentially, like, the deal they cut when they got married is he has to be home by sunset on Friday, and, like, their house is basically Shomer Shabbat, but he can eat a ham sandwich at work. Okay? In other words, it's basically our home is this way, etc. So he was an assistant U.S. attorney, and was in this office where he basically, you know, came in and negotiated this whole thing of like, okay, like on Fridays in the winter, I have to leave at 2:45, which is like kind of crazy, right? But it was like, okay, I'm presenting this, he's definitely extremely normal guy, presenting this. Then his boss sees him eating a ham sandwich like next week. And he's like, what's going on here, right? Now he somehow sort of talked his way out of that or explained or whatever it is. But there was a sense there, I think, part of what that captured for me is the normalcy piece is also what are the forms that are out there in the world? Like, we don't just make arrangements for ourselves. We also help set the culture for what is it to be a normal observant person in the workplace with respect to those things, and what we do as consequences for others and vice versa. I think that's really interesting and important. Let's look at this last text, and then we'll talk for our final bunch of minutes. So this is a Gemara in Bavli Megillah. We'll read it and go through it. Rav Ikla leBavel b'Ta'anit Zibur. Rav came to Bavel, and it was a public fast day. Nafuul kulei alma anpayu, v'Rav lo nafal al anpei. Everyone was doing nefilat apayim, was doing tachanun, basically, okay, and falling down, whether all the way to the ground, probably all the way to the ground, it looks like from the context. And Rav did not. Maitama Rav lo nafal al apei. Why didn't he? Well, there was a ritzpah shel avanim there. There was a stone floor, and there's a prohibition on going down flat on a stone floor. right? For anyone who's ever been in a place on Yom Kippur where people are putting out a little mat or having a tallit go under them, it's to create some kind of break between them and the floor. The notion you don't fully prostrate on a stone floor. Okay, and the next line explains that. If you go down to the fourth line, two words in. Ihachi mai ir yarav afilu kulu namen. Like, well, what do you mean? Then why was Rav not falling down? If the synagogue had a stone floor, then no one should have been going down to the ground. So why was everyone doing it? Kamei de Rav Havai. It was actually a patch of stone floor that was only in front of him. Okay, but not in front of everyone else. V'lezi legabe tzibura v'lin pol alape. So why didn't he just move to the carpeted part and then go down on the ground? Labai lemitrach tzibura. He didn't want to annoy people. He didn't want to, like, you know, elbow people out of the way or say, excuse me, can I come through? So he didn't want to disrupt them. Another possibility is that Rav was not just falling down on the ground, but he was going all the way flat down, and maybe only going all the way flat down is the problem on a stone floor. And what was happening here was there was a stone floor in the whole synagogue. Everyone else was doing like a half falling over, which is permissible according to Ula, who they quote here, on a stone floor. But Rav's practice was to go full flat. So since that would have been forbidden, he didn't do it because he had a different practice from the rest of the community. So then they say, well, why didn't he just this time do the half bow, lipol al hapeh, but not spread his arms and legs out in a full prostration? La mishane mimin hagei. He didn't want to change from his normal practice. Okay, normal now being used in a different way. His, let's say, conventional practice of what he used to do. Okay, he didn't want to be like, well, normally I do it, but because I'm in this community, I'm going to change. Right? You see that there's a resistance here. Rav is standing out. Okay, v'ibayit ema. Another possibility is adam chashuv shane. Maybe actually we're talking here about him being a significantly important person. And that put him in a different category. I actually don't want to get into the details of how that works out. Right? But you see, what's important about this story is, for anyone who is in any way motivated by some of the earlier texts we saw, of don't stand when people are sitting, and don't sit when people are standing, this data point is like a counter data point that they have to deal with. Like, because Rav is not abiding by that stricture, apparently. Right? Rav is willing to come into a place where everyone goes flat, and he won't do it. Not only that, he won't even do a version of his practice which would fit in with that group. Okay? So, in response to this, the Chida, who is in this next source, is dealing with the question, this is Parshat Shavua, the debate of whether it is appropriate to stand during Aseret HaDibrot when you read Parshat Yitro. A highly normative practice articulated by the Rambam is that it is forbidden to do that because it is a manifestation of what the Mishnah describes as the reason we don't say Aseret HaDibrot as a liturgical item every morning, which is basically heretics. It seems like it's not maybe only the Christians, but definitely the Christians. We're like, that's the Torah. That's the real thing. Everything else is whatever. But like, that's the thing you put up on the courthouse, right? The Ten Commandments. And so actually standing for that part of the Torah is to enact some preference for that part of the Torah, which is against the whole Jewish approach, which is to say, this whole thing, right? Even v'timnahi tafilegish, even the most like, sort of marginal psukim, are all eternal Torah. But in a lot of communities, it was like, wait, it's a standing ground, you have to stand, right? Like, there's sort of this intuitive need to do it. So you would have conflicts in communities, people would go. So they end up in a community where they're standing for Aseret HaDibrot. And I think, this is now getting to your situation, I think you shouldn't be. So how do I navigate that? Like, I think they're doing something wrong, but isn't there this impulse of like, lo yeshev ben ha'omdim, okay? And vice versa. All right, so the Chida here says the following, the end of the first line. Ach yesh lomar, here's how we can resolve how it is that Rav behaved in this way, and that could give us guidance with respect to the Ten Commandments situation. Chada, the first thing is, ki naful kule alma a'apayu lo minkar kokach de Rav lo nafil. De kulu tri de benefilat apayim ve'inam istaklim bo, ula'achar shesimu ve'ro'im de Rav lo nafil, Yomru, the gamuna follow me hairless sayin. When you don't do nefilat apayim, when you don't fall down, right? What is all that's happening? It might be that no one really can tell. Because what's everyone else doing? They're falling down on the ground. They're not looking. When they get up and they see Rav is standing, right? They'll think, he just did it more quickly than me. In other words, this is a place where Rav is departing from the communal practice, but in an unobtrusive way. He wouldn't have done it in a way that would have disrupted. If anything, by the way, proof for this is the Gemara's description that he didn't want to elbow through and bother people, right?
Is it
in other words,
against this that there's a Gemara about it? Like, it's a ridiculous thing to say no one knew, but we're learning something from the fact that he did.
Yeah, but no, but right, I understand. But the idea is this. In other words, we, the curators of Rav's traditions, know it, because maybe Rav came back and told us. But the scene we're imagining as it played out is that actually no one else there could detect it. Okay? That's how you would have to read it. I agree. Right? And this is the notion of, is there a way that you can sort of blend in, right? The analog to what, it doesn't work for a daily minion, right? But it's like, the analog would be someone who was a levy in a shul like that, I think we've talked about this, basically like only accepting maftir, which either can go to a levy or a non-levy. Right? In other words, you find some way that basically you do something that doesn't violate your principles, but that other people don't perceive as a slap in their face of their practice. Okay? That's right, correct. The chida, right, the chida is saying maybe that's one way of understanding why Rav was willing to be different. But what's actually really interesting is it's saying, yeah, so you might have to be different, but there's this desire to find a way that basically as few people have to notice it or confront it as possible. Inami, alternatively, d'chi amrinan lo yeshev bein ha'omdim, when we say this thing of don't sit when other people are standing, hainu shelo yesh lo ta'am, when you have no real reason or value that causes you to depart from the community, it's a very different resolution. Aval hacha, rav ta'am ataim, de'ihu pishut yadayim v'raglayim avid, v'lo mashanim imin hagei. Here he had a perfectly good reason where someone would come over and say, hey, why are you doing that? And he would say, well, because my practice of nefilat apayim is I go flat to the floor, and that wouldn't be allowed here because there's a stone floor. In other words, he would basically just be transparent and explain it. And then people would say, oh, I get it. You have something you care about. This is much more like saying, I have to order this kind of lunch, whatever it is. But it's like clear. It's not like I'm just trying to be like, eh, that's not the way I do it. I don't want to do it. But this actually conflicts some internal value. But then concludes the chida, aval b'li ta'am ein la'amod ben ha'yoshvi. In other words, this I think is actually an interesting check. Like, if you're going to depart and stand out, do you check yourself and say, am I doing this like just dafka to be different? Dafka to create some like individual distinctive space for me? Or is it like, no, it's like actually a reason. So this Rav Ovadia Yosef, when he takes up this question, he for this reason is in favor of people going to shuls where they stand for Aseret HaDibrot and sitting. Because he says the person can say, the Rambam says I have to sit. And I follow that, and it's legitimate essentially to quote a renowned posek, you know, with weight to their position as basis for deviation. And therefore that case is, you know, he basically disagrees with the Chida and says, it's an interesting thing, he's like, had the Chida seen the Tshuva of the Rambam, he wouldn't have written what he wrote. Whether that's true or not, we could speculate, but I think you see here a really interesting engagement with this question of, does perhaps having some kind of motivation from within, you know, justify that kind of deviation. Okay, so let's take another round of stuff. Yeah,
Sarah,
David, Svi, Joel,
and...
Have
Daphne doing something different to start a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's something that is important to be aware of Malik Ayn. I mean, I still struggle with that question with my parents' community back at home. This exact question of whether to sit or to stand, and sitting could just look like, oh, I don't care, I'm just lazy, I'm just going to sit.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So maybe the person sitting next to me might ask if they're like family members or friends, but other people would be like, oh, that's the one who goes to Hadar and sits.
Right, so there, that's right. And I think it's a more dramatic way of checking yourself. In other words, if the alternative is there might be a sense of zilzul, like it might be ascribed to you that you were doing something disrespectful, then you better be very sure that it would be a real violation of something you stand for in order to be willing to take that hit.
If you're also standing for more things that are different, you have to be even maybe more careful because you're more in a spotlight and being judged and already seen as different, and then maybe even people will question you less because you're anyways a little bit different.
Right. And there, I think what you're also pointing to is, look, I think totally central here is being extremely perceptive of your surroundings, right? I was just going back to my example of like the standing for Kaddish thing for a minute, right? Like, you know, you're in a shul where like everyone sits for mourners Kaddish except the mourners, okay? Like everyone. And you're the only one who gets up. If you're honest with yourself, that is actually a demonstrative statement of critique. There is no other way that that can really be perceived. It is very different if, what if there's like five people who stand? There's like 100 who sit, but there's a few people. Then it's more of a statement of like, oh, like I'm one of those, which is a recognizable subset in your ecosystem.
And everyone has to start somewhere, you know?
That's right.
And to do some different things can, again, but it goes back to the saying earlier, start a conversation. Another issue that comes up
Right.
Where there's a growing trend of actually staying because
yeah.
it's not anything different, and you should also be remembering people.
Yes. Correct. And that was actually very contentious in the early years of Hadar. Rav Shai would get up before Yizkor, and like in the early years, he would basically be like, unless this is super important to you, you should not leave. You're like abandoning the people who are here and making them feel alone, etc. And he got major blowback. There are people who are like, no, like, my practice of leaving is, like, actually important to me. So I'm like, oh, I don't have to be in Yizkor, so I'd rather not be there. And you're depriving something from me. And then the language was modified to try to say, we understand some people have a really strong custom. If so, right, it was trying to sort of encode the Chida's language for Rav here. Which is like, well, if you really have a tom for doing this, totally respect that. If you could really go either way, we ask you to stay. All right, but that was an effort to navigate that. That would speak.
Actually, said is part of this, and that the sources that we've looked at so far speak about normalcy as kind of an individual mandate, as an individual decision, and not in terms of a community decision. They're not; these aren't sources that saying like, you know, we compel people one way or the other to be normal. And you can imagine, I mean, there are societies like French society, Quebecois society, where normalcy is a societal value, where it's important that everyone act a certain way, even to you know, the detriment sometimes of their religious values, and like the questions of like kashrut or head coverings would be treated differently there than they would be in America. So I wonder, like, if is this just the way that the sources in the Talmud deal with normalcy, or is it also dealt with on the societal level?
Yeah, I don't have an answer for you. I would say that's one of the next questions that would be interesting to pursue. I think it's an important angle, because the original source is not as formulated as you said, 100%. Yeah, Joel and then Helen, and then we're gonna wrap.
Just a few things. One, the Chidah, I think, is really interesting about Im Yesh Lo Tam. Just in my experience, is a question not just if you have a reason, but a reason that will be palatable to people and maybe even inspire them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Versus those reasons. And some of the people are like, oh, it's great. He has a different thing, but he's thinking about this stuff. It's great. Otherwise, it's like, when it doesn't look like a critique, but it looks like, oh, that's his way he's doing things.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think there's like, sometimes there's a personal story. When I was in Ann Arbor, so I traditionally prefer to do Kaddish a little bit differently than people. It's the Minag of Tur and the Gra of only seven Lashonei Shevach, right? And then so to not say Vitalel. It was the shul, it was a mix. There were Chabad Davin there and regular Orthodox, and they did their own Kaddish when they did it, Smach Borkanei and so forth. So I figured, oh, okay, I can do my own. Who cares? Everyone's doing their own thing. And the rabbi took me aside and he said, like, Joel, I noticed you're doing something different. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, Chabad does stuff different. I figured, but he said, look, I'm not going to be able to control them. It's never going to happen. Do me a favor. Just do it the way we do it. And I said, yeah, okay, you know, like, there's some people who sometimes you can't stand out, even though other people are, like, you know, because that was the right thing to do there.
Well, they had, I think the other thing is, they had some critical mass, which
they
you did not.
Also, and I did not. So it's a good point, yeah.
And that's another part of the dynamic. Yeah, Helen.
I guess I'm wondering about it in terms of what the who we're trying to move. Like, is standing out to be like, I have this thing that I want to hold, and I think I can stand up for that myself, and I just want that to be my thing. Like, my shul sits for Kaddish, as you know, so I sit for Kaddish, and I don't really feel like that's the thing I need to move this community on. I just sit for Kaddish, no big deal. There are other things I feel like in the wide world that are outside of the Jews were standing out because there is more values in it, right? Like, kind of going back to, like, what kind of Brion are we surrounding ourselves with, and what kind of decision is that going to affect in how we can move people to actually start a conversation and change behavior? Like, the what to what extent are we trying to change behavior by standing out? I think it's really important.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that's captured in some meaningful way by this Ta'am language of, like, you know, do you have a reason for what you're doing? And I think you're adding another dimension, which is, I could have a reason that I'm actually deeply, you might even think of three categories, right? There's what you're describing as your Kaddish practice is like, this is my convention. I don't know, it's a better, worse, whatever it is, like, but I feel it's legitimate enough that, like, I'm going to do it, right? And then there's sort of a level of like a ta'am, which is a sort of internally motivated and directed one, which is like, no, this is why, think about Rav here. It's like, he's not necessarily thinking that everyone else shouldn't bow down. It's not clear that that's the case. But he's like, I think it's really important that I do it my way. Then you get to the Aseret HaDibrot case, right? Let's say the Rambam and Rav Ovadia, but other cases now I think you're projecting beyond, where no, the ta'am is not just like, I think this is the right way and I'm going to act this, but like I actually have an agenda of changing. That's where I think, that's why I offered you the, you know, the Da'at HaBriyot and Shem Shamayim Mitaheva Yadecha pieces. I think counterintuitively, sometimes the ability to change people and influence them depends on some degree of them being able to identify with you. But that's dangerous, right? Because it can break down. That's where I just wanted to end with this last source. The tour begins his whole code of all of Jewish law with this kind of amazing statement. And he says, Yehuda ben Tema Omer in Pirkei Avot, Heve Azkin Amer. Among other things, you have to be like stubborn and fierce as a leopard. Okay? What does that mean? So he says in the middle of the second line, Lefi. Lefi shehu klal gadol ba'avodat ha-borei yitbarach. This is a central rule in worshiping God. Sometimes someone wants to do a mitzvah and they don't do it because they're afraid people are going to make fun of them. Sometimes people go to a math competition and they're like, I'm not going to put on tefillin. That's way too embarrassing. The Alkin, and therefore, Yehuda ben Tema, he's here, says, Shita'iz panecha keneged ha-maligin. Make yourself kind of stubborn, stone-faced with respect to those who would make fun of you. Ve'al timana milasot ha-mitzvah. And don't thereby refrain from doing the mitzvah. Ve'chein amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai le-talmidav. What did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say to his students? Yehi ratzon shetehei mora shamayim aleichem kemora basar vadam. I wish for you to be as afraid of God as you are of people. Mm-hmm. And it's actually an amazing statement because we all know what that feels like, right? It's like every time I'm like driving down the highway and it's like, I'm going, you know, 80, which I do with some regularity. And like, you know, I see a police car there and it's like my heart stops. And I think to myself, like, what if my Yirat Shamayim was at that level? Serious, right? That's like unbelievable. That's what like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying. Like, how can you have the fear we have of people is actually profound and deep. And the just little piece of antidote here I give you at the end, because I don't want you to come away with just like, yes, it's all about being normal all the time, is that obviously there's got to be this element of like, we are, whether it's to change our surroundings or just retain the spine of who we are, like, you cannot be totally, you know, subdued to the forces of conventionality around you. I think what I've tried to throw out some language here for is standing for the things you're important for, though, doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be a complete and total outsider. And it could be that we're actually called on to seek the ways in which we can be sort of normal and fitting in while maintaining those commitments.